It's 10:06. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, the decision that everyone's been waiting for with bated breath, seemingly for months, possibly even years, is in. And the Supreme Court has upheld most of the Affordable Care Act. And what does that mean? We're talking about it this morning. And by the way, we'll continue to talk about it, I'm sure, all day long. I have a hunch that that will be the main topic of discussion during At Issue this afternoon. And then at 6 o'clock tonight, there'll be an NPR special carried on the Ideas Network about this decision and its ramifications. So two guests with me this morning to help sort out both the legal and healthcare aspects of this decision. Andrew Cohen, Assistant Professor of Law at the University of Wisconsin Law School, is with me. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
And David Howard, Ph.D., Associate Professor of Health Policy and Management at Emory's Rollins School of Public Health, is also with me. Professor Howard, good morning. Oh, not yet. Okay, we're bringing him in. All right. Okay. Well, you know, no plan survives the first day of war. Professor Howard, did this decision surprise you in any way?
It's Professor Cohen here, but yes, the rationale for the decision surprised me quite a lot. I thought that the act's chances of being upheld after listening to the oral arguments were somewhere in the neighborhood of 50-50, but the court upheld it in quite an unusual way.
Yeah, they basically said, and I'm just looking at the decision now, which is, I'm not reading the whole thing, and the print's rather small, that the Congress didn't have the power through the Commerce Clause for the individual insurance mandate, which was at the heart of the Affordable Care Act, or at least the constitutional arguments, but it did have the power to impose this as a tax. Talk about that a little bit.
So that's right. The government's principal argument, its lead argument in all of the litigation over the Affordable Care Act that has taken place in the lower federal courts to this point, which is quite a lot, was that the requirement imposed by the Act that all non-exempt individuals purchase health insurance was an exercise of Congress's power under Article 1 of the Constitution to regulate commerce among the several states. The idea was that the health insurance market is a very significant component of the national economy, that decisions whether or not to purchase health insurance, at least in the aggregate, have national economic effects, and therefore a requirement that individuals purchase health insurance was a regulation of economic activity. The challengers said, no, this is a regulation of economic inactivity. Inactivity can't be commerce. If inactivity could be commerce, there would be no limit to federal power, and we know that the Constitution established a government of limited powers. The court agreed with the challengers on that point, but it nevertheless found that the penalty which the Act uses to enforce the individual mandate, which the Act uses to enforce the requirement that individuals purchase insurance, actually has all of the characteristics of a tax. And even though it's not called a tax by the Act, that doesn't resolve the issue. That as long as it functions like a tax, that Congress is permitted to enact it under its taxation power, which in some instances is broader than its power to regulate commerce.
Now, the so that's one part of this. I believe that was the government's secondary argument. Their first argument was that this is legal under the Commerce Clause. The second is, well, the penalty is a tax, I think. And so that part, the court said, yeah, okay, you're right on that. And then there was also a piece on the Medicaid funding for the states and what the federal government was going to do with that. Could you try to explain that to us a little bit?
Sure. Medicaid, of course, is an existing federal program through which the federal government gives substantial grants to state governments to fund the provision of health care to low-income individuals, especially low-income children and low-income adults with children. It's a very large source of funding for many states. In fact, on average, I think it constitutes roughly 10% of the typical state's annual budget. The Affordable Care Act substantially expands Medicaid. It requires that states provide, it both provides funding and requires that states extend coverage under the Medicaid program to individuals with incomes up to 133% of the poverty line. It, as in the original Medicaid program, the money provided by the Affordable Care Act to fund this expansion comes with strings attached. And in fact, not only does the Act require that states administer this new expanded program in particular ways, it requires states to participate in the expanded program on pain or on penalty of losing all of their Medicaid funds, which, as you can imagine, is a pretty big stick when those funds constitute 10% of a typical state's budget. So what the states had argued before the court was that this aspect of the Act really doesn't give them a choice, and the federal Constitution does not permit Congress to tell states how to regulate, to tell states how to run their own government programs. And therefore, the states, including the state of Wisconsin, had asked the court to hold that the Act's expansion of Medicaid was unconstitutional.
How is this different from the federal government saying to the states, unless you pass a law requiring seatbelt use, you're going to lose your highway funds?
Well, it's similar. It's very similar. And in fact, that was the government's principal argument. There is a famous Supreme Court case from 1987, at least famous among constitutional lawyers, involving a very similar federal program, which conditioned the grant of state highway funds on states' willingness to raise their drinking age to the age of 21. And the court said that's just fine. Congress doesn't have to give you those highway funds in the first place, so it is perfectly constitutional for them to give you those funds with some strings attached. And if you don't want to raise your drinking age, you don't have to take the money. Well, Congress had said the same thing here. If you don't want to expand Medicaid in accordance with the Affordable Care Act, you don't have to take the new money, and in fact, you don't have to take the old money either. But states had said, had argued, and the court found this argument persuasive, that choice, that nominal choice, was really no choice at all. It was an offer that the states couldn't refuse because the threat to withdraw funds for the entire Medicaid program, on which states have come to greatly depend over the last several decades, was effectively like putting a gun to their head.
I want to welcome in David Howard, Associate Professor of Health Policy and Management at Emory's Rollins School of Public Health. Professor, welcome. I'm glad we were able to get you connected here.
Thank you.
Were you surprised by this morning's announcement?
Sure. I think everyone expected the mandate to potentially be overturned, but the Medicaid provision, which could potentially be more significant, they did not expect the court to overturn that provision, but they've struck a pretty significant blow for expansion of coverage under the Affordable Care Act.
So what do you, from a healthcare perspective, what does that Medicaid portion of the decision mean for the citizens?
Well, so the Medicaid expansion would have covered everyone with incomes below 133% of the federal poverty level, resulting in an expansion of insurance coverage by about 17 million people. If some states opt out of the Medicaid expansion, which they're allowed to do under the Supreme Court's ruling, many fewer people will be covered.
And what will happen to them?
Well, so it's kind of unclear. The Affordable Care Act also offers subsidies for people to buy health insurance in the private market. And I think that the people that people who are not eligible for Medicaid with incomes below 133% of the federal poverty level will now be eligible for those subsidies, which the cost of which will be borne by the federal government. But no one really envisioned this possibility when writing up the Affordable Care Act, so it's a little bit unclear.
I want to go back to Professor Cohen for just a moment here. The configuration of the justices in this decision was a little bit different than what we have been used to seeing from the court. Chief Justice Roberts joined the liberals of the court in the majority. How significant is that?
Well, I think it's fairly significant, and I think it's consistent with predictions that we've been hearing from some Supreme Court observers that Chief Justice Roberts, in a case of this magnitude, would have at least one eye on his historical legacy. It's difficult to predict the future in these matters, of course, but it seems likely that when people eventually look back on Chief Justice Roberts' tenure at the head of the Supreme Court, this is one of the cases that he will be remembered for. A lot of people thought that he would be thinking very carefully about that, and that might give him some extra pause in deciding to strike down this law. What I think is particularly interesting about the configuration of the justices in this case is that Chief Justice Roberts joined the liberals on the ultimate outcome. He, like they, concluded that the individual mandate could be upheld as a tax, but he embraced a great deal of the substance of the challenger's argument in this case. And going into today's decision, I thought this case had the potential to be of great practical significance in the effect that it had on the Affordable Care Act, but limited legal significance for future cases. In the end, I think that as the case was actually decided, it might be quite the reverse. The Affordable Care Act will mostly remain in place. The court did place important limitations on the penalties at Congress's disposal to encourage compliance with the Medicaid expansion provisions. Chief Justice Roberts endorsed fairly strongly, along with the conservative dissenters in the case, a new limit on the federal commerce power, which the court has never endorsed before.
And I want to get to that. We need to take a break. I've got a couple of announcements I need to make, one of which is that today at 12:15 p.m. Eastern Time, that would be 11:15 p.m. for those of us in the flyover zone, the president will deliver a statement about the Supreme Court decision from the East Room of the White House, and we will carry that from National Public Radio. Interrupting our regularly scheduled programming, the Larry Mueller program, to bring you the statement and the press conference which follows this. So President Obama will be talking about the decision and its aftermath and then taking questions from the press, that at 11:15 our time. And then later on tonight, we'll carry a National Public Radio special report on this decision starting at 6 o'clock. And that will be carried on the Ideas Network stations of Wisconsin Public Radio as well. So we're all over this today on the Ideas Network. This hour, our focus is on the decision, the constitutional questions, the legal questions surrounding this, and the implications for the future of health care in the United States. So that's why we have a guest who's an expert in each one of these things. Of course, there's going to be a tremendous political fallout from this. That is not what we're talking about this hour. As tempting as that might be, that's not what we're talking about. What I would like to know from listeners is, what did you think when you heard the decision? Did you were you hoping the court would uphold this law? Were you hoping that it would strike it down? And why? And what does this mean to you? What do you think about it? 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And you can also find the Kathleen Dunn Program on Facebook and leave your comment or question there. We're talking about the constitutional and the health care aspects of this decision by the Supreme Court of the United States, and wondering what you think. Again, 800-486-8655, and we'll start taking your calls in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 22 minutes past 10 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And once again, just a reminder, the president will be speaking at 12:15 Eastern time today. That's 11:15 our time. And delivering a statement on this decision by the Supreme Court to uphold, for the most part, the Affordable Care Act. And we've talked about this in the constitutional realm, and there will be more discussion on that this hour and also on the health care part of it. Tonight at 6 on the Ideas Network, we'll bring you an NPR News special on the U.S. Supreme Court ruling. And so a couple of things to look forward there, too. But 11:15 this morning during the Larry Mueller program, we will break into that to carry the president's remarks and the press conference, which will follow it. All right. Let me reintroduce our guests and then go to the phones. We've got people who want to talk to us. Had some emails as well. We'll get to those in just a moment. Andrew Cohen, assistant professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School, is with me, as is David Howard, Ph.D., associate professor of health policy and management at Emory's Rollins School of Public Health. Let's start in Columbia County, and here is Mike with us this morning. Mike, good morning.
Good morning to John and the guests. Personally, I am not affected by any provisions of this law because I'm covered by the military retirement system and the Veterans Administration. But personally, I was just elated. I was so excited I could barely call any of my more conservative friends and tell them, especially about Judge Roberts and his potential to be maybe what one of the professors could say what his, I thought he was a strict constructionist, but maybe they could elaborate on what his, how they would analyze his part of the decision. Personally, bottom line, John, I was so excited I could barely speak. So I just wanted to tell you that and was glad. And I'm waiting for Hugh to call in from Milwaukee and see what his conservative take, because I always enjoy his comments.
Well, you can tell Mike is a longtime Ideas Network listener. He even knows who the other regulars are. That's pretty good. Professor Cohen, we talked a little bit about Chief Justice Roberts' thinking on this. Let me just add to what Mike said there and have you respond. Do you think that Justice Roberts was thinking about the reputation of the court? I mean, there's been a lot of criticism of the Supreme Court of the United States as having been become extremely politicized in recent years. Do you think that there was any of this in his decision, that he wanted to maybe avert some of that criticism?
Well, certainly there's been a lot of speculation to that effect. I think it's always difficult to try to psychoanalyze the justices from a spectator's vantage point. But this would have been a very major step for the court to take. There are only a handful of examples in American history where the court has struck down the centerpiece of a sitting president's agenda or an important legislative component of that agenda. I think you'd probably have to go back to the New Deal to find a comparable example. In that circumstance, things did not turn out especially well for the court. There are a lot of differences between that circumstance and the present circumstance, but that certainly may have been in the back of his mind. Another thing that occurs to me as I read over his opinion, and I certainly haven't had a chance to fully digest it yet, since it was released electronically just a few minutes before we went on the air here, but it has the appearance of trying to give something to both sides, not just in the fact that it upholds the mandate while limiting the Medicaid expansion, but in the sense that it upholds the mandate while strongly embracing the centerpiece of the challenger's argument that the mandate cannot be upheld under the commerce power.
And I wanted to, Professor Howard, to touch on something that Mike said at the beginning of his comments. He was excited about the decision, but he said, basically, this doesn't affect me because I'm in a different system For a lot of us, when the Affordable Care Act goes into place, if we already have health care insurance, it isn't necessarily going to affect everyone, who will be affected and who won't really notice any difference with as the Affordable Care Act is fully implemented?
Sure. For people with who already have Medicaid, Medicare insurance through the military or the VA, everyone is affected in some way by the Affordable Care Act, but they're not going to be affected as much. For people with insurance through their employer, they too will not be as affected, although if they get sick and have to stop working and then buy insurance on the individual market, then they could be affected. But for really the people who are targeted by the Affordable Care Act are people who currently buy insurance in the individual market, that is, who do not get insurance through their employer, and people who are uninsured. But I'd like to say one thing about a lot of news organizations are now pitching the Supreme Court's ruling as a victory for the Obama administration and the Affordable Care Act. But I think as people dig deeper, they'll see that the ruling on the Medicaid provision is going to be pretty significant. Again, 17 million people are supposed to get coverage through this Medicaid expansion. And if a lot of states now decline to expand Medicaid as intended under the Affordable Care Act, that could prove a lot of headaches for the federal government, where you have people with incomes above 133% of the federal poverty level now being covered, but poor people will not get covered. So this is a pretty significant provision and ruling by the Supreme Court with respect to that aspect of the Affordable Care Act.
And this would mean that state elections are determinative, right?
Yes,
I mean, it'll be
exactly
up for the governors to decide.
I'm not a political analyst, but you can imagine that there will be a lot of governors who, on the one hand, stake the claim that this is the federal government helping to subsidize coverage of our citizens. How can we not take this? But other governors see this as a chance to stick it to the Obama administration and reject the, stake a claim on their position on the Affordable Care Act and reject Medicaid expansion.
All right, let's take another call here. It'll be Ann in Madison next. Ann, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Just to answer your first question, I'm very excited about this finding. I was surprised. I was all set to be terribly disappointed. So I'm happy about it. I might even write John Roberts a little note. But I did have a question about the Medicare situation. Professor Cohn earlier said that the justices found that threatening to remove the Medicare money, which is a big percentage of the state's budget, was found to be not fair or something by the court. But the fact of the matter is I didn't really get the difference between the seatbelt or the drinking law, because the federal money for highways is a fairly large portion of the state fund, so I just don't understand the difference, and I'd like to have that discussed again. Maybe I can get it.
And just to clarify, it was Medicaid, not Medicare. But Professor Cohn, if you want to review that again, please.
Sure. Well, I think this is a very hard distinction to make. The government argued that there was no distinction. And as I mentioned earlier, I have not yet had a chance to fully digest, really not even close, the court's analysis of this question, because the opinions came down just before we went on the air here. But from the quick glance I was able to take at them, the court's explanation seems to be that Medicaid is such a large program and the states have come to rely so greatly upon it over the past several decades, and this new change is such a major change that it represents not just a quantitative difference in terms of the types of conditions that the federal government is imposing on the funds that it grants to state governments, but a qualitative difference, a difference in kind from programs like the federal highway funds, which, of course, do come with all kinds of strings attached. But that's really the best that I can offer you at this point, because I really haven't been able to digest these opinions.
Ann, thanks for the call. We had someone, let's see if I can get back to this on my screen. Judy sent us an email and said, I can't describe how thrilled I am that the Affordable Care Act was upheld. Our healthcare system was just made more secure and available for all of us. Professor Howard, is that true? Was our healthcare system just made more secure and affordable for all of us?
Oh, that's a simple question to a complicated issue, but you know, for people who, again, for people who have employer-based health insurance and may at some point get sick and have to stop working and drop employer coverage, the mandate by bringing healthy people into the individual market will help to buttress the market and make individual insurance more affordable for people who may need it in the future. So for people who currently have employer-based health insurance, the answer, I think, is yes. For people who are uninsured with incomes below 133% of the federal poverty level, they, you know, again, it depends on how their state reacts. If their state accepts Medicaid expansion, they will be well covered. If the state does not accept the Medicaid expansion, you might have a large number of people who continue to remain uninsured.
Just to kind of help us get a handle on this, the way the Affordable Care Act is designed, will the states incur more expenses under this that wouldn't be covered by the federal government?
So initially it's set up that the federal government pays a large share of any Medicaid expansions. But over time, the federal subsidy rate declines, and so states have to bear a larger share of the cost. And so for states that opt to join Medicaid, opt to expand Medicaid in accordance with the Affordable Care Act, their state spending will go up.
And the court ruled, according to the decision, that the Medicaid expansion violates the Constitution by threatening states with the loss of their existing Medicaid funding if they decline to comply with the expansion. More phone calls. Let's see. David in San Francisco, California is with us. David, good morning.
Hey, morning. I was interested in basically the polluter's burden on medical costs. If you were to look at the basic polluting of America or the entire world, and the polluters basically are not paying the medical bills. And they've known for 50, 75 years that this problem is going to build up. And so as you watch Michael Moore's movie Sicko, there's a scene in there where John Ehrlichman and Richard Nixon are conspiring essentially to tear apart the Hippocratic Oath and to create the HMOs. And I'm wondering if the professors are, first of all, familiar with that section. And then the idea that America has been divided by these HMOs, in that if you were to look at pollution forcing whole neighborhoods to be given cancer clusters, and to have everybody on individual policies with individual companies doesn't reflect the monitoring of those cancer clusters. So once people are put on something like single payer, all of a sudden we're going to start to see the true polluter's burden, because those cancer clusters will start to emerge and the true costs of pollution on society are going to emerge.
David Howard, would you respond to that, please?
In terms of, so some people argued that the Affordable Care Act was an opportunity to really address the fundamental causes of poor health and go beyond just expanding insurance coverage. People have differing opinions about the degree to which pollution is linked to cancer and the existence of cancer clusters, but one aspect that we know is, one area of poor health that we know is amenable to change and a big source of health care cost is obesity. So the Affordable Care Act does include some provisions to try to fund more prevention, lifestyle changes, But those are a pretty minor part of the overall act. The main gist of the Affordable Care Act is to expand insurance coverage.
And I don't know, Professor Cohen, if there was anything in that for you, but if you want to chime in, now would be a good time.
No, I think that was pretty much a healthcare policy question.
Okay.
I'll leave that to Professor Howard.
Okay, here's an email from Gene in Reedsburg. We are relieved that most of the Affordable Care Act has been upheld. We trail behind the rest of the developed world in providing health care, and it has been a national shame. We are the richest country in the world. We can most certainly afford to offer access to high-quality health care to all Americans. This act isn't enough, but it is a good start. David Howard, would you agree with that sentiment?
Yeah, I mean, I think this does greatly expand the number of Americans who have health insurance, but it's not going to be cheap. And I think that the way they wrote the bill, the benefits are very visible, but some of the costs are more hidden. There will be increased taxes for upper-income individuals. Medical device companies have to pay higher taxes. And payments to hospitals and other health care providers under the federal Medicare program are not going to rise as rapidly over time as they otherwise might. That may have consequences for the quality of care. So, you know, I just think it's important to remember that this bill isn't a free lunch. It does expand insurance coverage, moving us more in line with much of Western Europe, but it's going to be costly.
Here's an email question from Connie, and Professor Cohen, this one's for you. My understanding is that there were three, not two, arguments. One, the Commerce Clause. Two, necessary and proper. And three, as a tax. So it was argument three that swayed the court. Please talk about the second argument, if you can.
Sure. Connie is exactly right, and I didn't interject to correct you on this earlier, John, but maybe I should have to clarify the issue for our readers. The Necessary and Proper Clause is part of Article 1 of the Constitution, which is a section of the Constitution that lays out the powers of the federal government, and it works in conjunction with the other powers that the Constitution grants to the federal government, and specifically to Congress. So the two arguments, the commerce argument and the necessary and proper argument, were addressed separately in the court's opinions, but really they go hand in hand with each other. What the necessary and proper clause says is that Congress not only has the power to regulate commerce among the several states, among many other things, it also has the power to pass all laws necessary and proper to carry into effect its commerce power and the other powers granted to it by the Constitution. Now, necessary and proper is kind of technical legal language. It sounds a little bit like legalese, but historically the court has basically interpreted that phrase to mean reasonably necessary or reasonably adapted to carrying out Congress's other powers, and it's given Congress a lot of discretion in deciding what the best means are to achieve the end of regulating interstate commerce or raising and supporting armies or whatever the other power it is that Congress is exercising at a given time. And in this case, Congress had argued that even if the individual mandate was not itself a regulation of commerce because the non-purchase of health insurance was an inactivity which couldn't really be described as commerce, that the individual mandate was still reasonably necessary to make the other regulations of commerce contained in the Affordable Care Act effective. Specifically, it was necessary to make the provisions of the Act which bar insurance companies from discriminating against people with pre-existing conditions work properly, because those conditions create a real temptation. Those provisions create a real temptation. If you know that you can never be denied health coverage based on your past conditions or your pre-existing conditions, then people have a real incentive to wait until they get sick to purchase health insurance. And if that's the way things work, the only people who will have health insurance will be sick people, and the premiums will necessarily go up as a result. So the individual mandate was designed to fix that problem, to ensure that everyone, healthy people and sick people, buy health insurance so that the risk of catastrophic health events is spread across the whole population. Congress said that's necessary. President Obama said that's necessary to make these other regulations effective, and therefore it's constitutional. The court said that it was not. And here's another place where I have not had a chance to closely examine the court's reasoning. My hunch is that the court relied on a similar argument here, relied on a similar argument to reject the necessary and proper clause argument of the government as it did to reject the government's Commerce Clause argument, and that is that if we allow Congress to do this, that Congress could do anything, and we know that the Constitution establishes a national government of limited power, so that's not an acceptable result.
We're talking about the decision made by the Supreme Court of the United States this morning in the matter of the Affordable Care Act, most of it upheld, one significant piece of it not, and taking your calls and getting your opinions and your questions for our two guests, one a constitutional scholar and a healthcare expert, both here for you this morning. Still time for some phone calls. We have pretty much full phone lines right now. We've got some emails to get to as well, so lots to do the rest of the hour. Just a reminder that our coverage of this issue continues throughout the day in various forms, including coverage of the president's remarks coming up at 11:15, about a little more than half an hour from right now. He'll be addressing reporters and the nation from the East Room of the White House, and we'll carry that live during the Larry Mueller program. And then later on today, tonight, at 6 o'clock, we'll have more coverage of this from National Public Radio. So stick around. The Ideas Network has you covered, kind of like insurance. Well, maybe that's not an analogy I want to make here. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll have some more calls and lots more to discuss. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10:45, and this just in, National Public Radio has just confirmed that they will have a full hour of coverage starting at 11 o'clock this morning. So we won't wait till 11:15. We'll go at 11 o'clock with NPR's coverage of this significant, to say the least, decision. Let me reintroduce my two guests this morning. Andrew Cohen is Assistant Professor of Law at the University of Wisconsin Law School, and David Howard, Ph.D., is Associate Professor of Health Policy and Management at Emory's Rollins School of Public Health. Let's go back to the phones. Greg in Madison will be next. Greg, good morning.
Thanks, John. And in answer to your question, I was surprised and pleased. My question is probably for Professor Cohen. Going into this, I thought there were four decisions to make, whether the mandate was constitutional, whether striking it down left the rest of the law intact, the Medicare question, and then this weird question of whether anybody could even rule on it, because in order to have standing, somebody has to be at the effect of the law. And they seemed to dispense with that during the first day of arguments. But then for them to come back and find that, it seems almost patrimonial for the court to say, we think this is a tax, even though the administration tried politically to deny that it was a tax. And that was very generous of them. But doesn't this question of standing still stand?
Well, standing is a technical legal issue which was not actually before the Supreme Court. Standing objections were raised to the legal challenges in some of the lower courts. I think that the issue the caller is has in mind actually relates to a statute, a jurisdictional statute called the Anti-Injunction Act. The point of the Anti-Injunction Act is to require anyone who wants to bring suit to challenge his or her tax liability to wait until a tax has actually been collected or paid. Although the government disclaimed this argument, one of the lower courts of appeals that was involved in the healthcare litigation before it made it to the Supreme Court said that it could not decide any of the issues raised by these constitutional challenges because any challenge to the mandate was a pre-enforcement challenge to the collection of a tax. And it was a pre-enforcement challenge because the mandate actually won't go into effect until 2014. So nobody has paid the penalty that the Act imposes for violating the mandate yet. And the Fourth Circuit said, look, the Anti-Injunction Act says we don't have jurisdiction over any case that attempts to challenge the constitutionality or anything else about a tax which hasn't been collected yet. Interestingly, the question of whether the individual mandate, at least interestingly to a legal type like me, the question of whether the mandate was a tax for purposes of the Anti-Injunction Act and the question of whether it was a tax for purposes of the taxation power under the Constitution are separate legal questions. And the court concluded that because the Act doesn't call it a tax, the individual mandate is not covered by the Anti-Injunction Act, and therefore a pre-enforcement challenge to the mandate is not barred. The court is not barred from hearing such a challenge. But it said that the statutory language does not resolve the question of whether this is an exercise of Congress's constitutional taxing power. And to reach that conclusion, it appears to have relied on a long series of precedents which say or which hold that Congress need not specifically invoke the constitutional powers that it is attempting to exercise, and that any act of Congress can be upheld on any valid constitutional ground, whether or not Congress has specifically sought to invoke that constitutional authority.
Greg, thanks for that question. Going forward, as this policy is implemented and we begin to see what it really is, and I hate to bring this up, but when she was a Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi said, we're going to have to pass this thing and get it into place to see how it works. Professor Howard, this is an incredibly complex piece of legislation. It was thousands of pages long. It really is going to take us a number of years, possibly even a decade or more, to really see how it all works, isn't it?
Yes, and I have not read the whole bill. I've read summaries and sections of it. But many of the big provisions that expand coverage are supposed to kick in 2014. And so we should have a good idea in the next, I would think 4 or 5 years as to the impact of the act on the number of people who are uninsured. Longer term, though, the act contains a number of provisions to reform Medicare, to change the way providers are paid, to try to lower the costs of the program, and these will have huge ramifications for the entire healthcare system, including how private insurers operate. And so for those types of changes, you're right, it's going to take a long time before we know how significant they are.
Well, Professor Howard, do you know how similar is the Affordable Care Act to the statewide insurance law that is in effect in Massachusetts? Do you know, and how is that program working?
They are very similar. So far, initial reviews of the Massachusetts CARE Act have been pretty good. One big concern is that because individuals in Massachusetts received subsidies to buy health insurance, that employers would drop health insurance. And that is a huge concern with the Affordable Care Act, with the federal poverty level, that employers who have mostly middle or low-income employees will say, hey, guess what? We're no longer going to pay for your health insurance because you now have access to subsidized health insurance in the individual market from the federal government. So far, that hasn't happened in Massachusetts, which is a good sign. But a lot of people think it's only a matter of time before employers do the math and figure out they can drop coverage, and that's going to be a big concern moving forward at the federal level, with the Affordable Care Act and nationwide.
Yeah, I would think this would be a huge issue because for a lot of people, the only way that they have coverage that they can afford is through their employer. And if they had to pay anything for it, it would be a significant piece of their monthly income, even with some kind of subsidy. Do we have any idea, even a wild guess? Let's say family of four, a mom and dad and two kids, and I realize that that's not necessarily, that certainly isn't everyone's situation, but just for these purposes, coverage is actually going to cost them per month, even with a subsidy?
So it really depends on the income level. For people with incomes between 133 and 150% of the federal poverty level, they would be expected to pay no more between 3% and 4% of their income for health insurance. For people with incomes between 300 and 400% of the federal poverty level, that goes up to almost 10% of income. But even now, I would say that people do have to bear a large share of employer-based health insurance because the premium is paid jointly by the employer and the employee.
All right. Let's take another call. Ann in Middleton.
Hi.
Ann, good morning.
Thanks for taking my call. Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
First of all, I'm thrilled by the Supreme Court's decision, especially John Roberts' participation in this. And I'd like to comment on how it affects me personally. Throughout my life, I've worked with people in poverty, and our health care system, Medicaid in particular, was only eligible to people that were a percentage of poverty, and really it was a disincentive to work, because what I saw in my work, a parent or two parents that were working full-time but just barely earning enough money and weren't eligible for their insurance to be paid by the employer, as soon as one of their kids or a family member became sick, they had to quit their employment to get eligible for Medicaid. Now, WT2 was supposed to address part of that in Wisconsin, but it really only addressed part of it. And there are many working poor, as we know, and my son is one of those. He only works part-time. He can't get full-time at work. He does have employer-sponsored insurance available, but it's more expensive than buying it on the private market. So he purchases it, but right now he's having some other issues and financial issues and can't afford his insurance, and yet he can't afford to be without insurance because he has health issues. So I have to subsidize him, and I'm hoping he might be able to get a benefit through this, as well as other people, of course.
And thanks for the call, Professor Howard.
Yeah, without knowing anything about the specific situation of your son, I believe he's exactly the type of person who the Affordable Care Act is intended to help. There are people now who may have good private insurance, but again, they or someone in their family get sick, they have to stop working, and they either can no longer afford their employer-based insurance or they get dropped from the plan. Now the Affordable Care Act is supposed to ensure that there is a robust and affordable individual option for those individuals, and there will be subsidies to help low-income persons buy into that market. So it's not going to be free, but I think that it'll probably cost much less than it does today. And, of course, it also depends a lot on the state where you live. Some states have very well-functioning individual insurance markets. In other states, not so much.
Professor Cohen, another constitutional question for you. Based on what the court has said about the Commerce Clause and Congress's exercise thereof, does this decision open the door to revisit other decisions Congress has made regarding the Commerce Clause? And what do you think this means for the future of the ability of Congress to regulate interstate commerce?
Well, here's another situation. I know I sound like a broken record here, if anybody remembers what records are these days. But it's a question that would be very difficult for me to answer without having read the opinions more closely. Just at a glance, it looks to me John Roberts and the conservative justices who joined him in finding the individual mandate unconstitutional under the Commerce Clause did so without calling into question any of the court's prior precedents, which interpret the commerce power quite broadly. There's my initial sense is that the decision itself doesn't really rock the boat in that way.
Let me try and draw an analogy for
sure.
You and just get you to comment on this. The First Amendment of the Bill of Rights protects free speech, but the court has ruled that it cannot compel speech. Is that essentially what the court is saying here?
No, I think that issue is quite different, but it would be probably too complicated for us to get into the distinctions between First Amendment doctrine and Commerce Clause doctrine here. But maybe the the more salient point is that any time the court attempts to, or in fact does, impose a new limit on federal power, it does suggest a certain sympathy to other challenges. How much sympathy depends, of course, on the precise wording of the opinion and the precise rationale that the court employs in limiting federal power. But certainly, in some sense, this decision could send a signal that this is a court that's receptive to federalism-based arguments against congressional regulation.
All right, and we're going to have to leave it there, Professor, because
sure.
we're out of time. I appreciate it. Andrew Cohen is Assistant Professor of Law at the University of Wisconsin Law School. David Howard, thank you for being with us as well. Associate Professor of Health Policy and Management at Emory's Rollins School of Public Health. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers for producing this program. I want to just point out that at 11 o'clock this morning, NPR's coverage begins, and they'll have coverage of President Obama's remarks as well. David Green hosts for National Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.